From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
I was sitting here pondering how many different puns I could use to get into this topic. For example, let's get down to earth, Joel. Or can you give me a good grounding on this topic, Joel? Or I could keep going and then somebody's going to throw a brick at me. So
that's true. That's one of the advantages of doing this by recording. We aren't here when they throw the brick.
We don't have an audience to boo and kiss at us. But tell me everything you know, Joel, about grounds. I mean, there are many kinds of grounds.
Well, that's true. And, well, there's really, yeah, I guess that you say there are many functions that we want from ground. I mean, there's one basic
kind of ground. Yeah, not kinds of grounds, but functions.
There's this planet Earth we talk about. And Earth is another word that's used for ground. And some people use it as a verb. They have things that are, they earth things and so forth. We tend to call it grounding. And we're well grounded in this. Turnabout is fair play. Anyway, number of topics that are important to talk about. One is, let's first talk about the different kinds of grounds. Starting with the most basic is an electrical safety ground. And that is a grounding scheme in which all equipment cabinets and structures are tied to the same ground point, usually through the power system. And this is what happens via the third green wire in an electrical plug. If you look at the typical electrical socket on the wall, you've got two flat pins that are the actual power, and then you've got kind of a not quite round, but almost round pin that's the ground pin. And that's for electrical safety ground. And the idea is that takes the cabinet of the equipment and takes it back to ground. And at the ground happens back at the service panel where the fuse box is or whatever. And at that point, that ground pin is connected, and only at that point, to the neutral wire of the power. So what that means is if the hot wire of the power in the equipment, because of an equipment failure, somehow ends up on the cabinet, instead of completing a circuit through you when you touch the cabinet, it'll instantly blow the fuse because it's hooked to the ground wire that goes back to the neutral. If that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the idea. And the idea is that you want to have all of your equipment at the same potential. So if you didn't have that set up that way, and you didn't have all of your equipment properly grounded, you could have some piece of equipment that got 120 volts AC on the cabinet and another piece that didn't. And when you go and put one hand on one and one on the other, then you get 120 volts going through you, which is quite uncomfortable and can be fatal. It usually isn't, but it can easily be fatal and has been. Probably every ham from the 50s did that, because back in those days, we didn't have that kind of socket. We had just a plain two-pin socket, and most equipment considered the pins equivalent, even though back at the fuse box, one of them was hooked to ground, the other one was hot. And they did clever things like have little capacitors in every radio equipment that from each side of the power line to the cabinet or chassis intended to reduce noise coming from the power line. Well, what happened with those is the capacitors got leaky, and after a while you had 120 volts on the cabinet. And then if you had an antenna, a coax cable that had a shield grounded outside someplace as it should be for lightning protection, and you had the connector in one hand and you leaned on the equipment with the other to plug it into the back of the equipment, you got 120 volts between the shield of the coax and the cabinet.
Ouch.
And I've done that many times. I think every ham in the 50s has done that. And you say, gee, that's interesting. Most equipment in those days, not all, but most equipment had a ground terminal. The idea was to implement that yourself by tying all the equipment together, running the ground terminal to a ground point in the station, and that eventually went to the same ground that the coax was grounded to someplace. So the idea is to have all of the equipment at the same ground potential. That almost happens with modern equipment that has the three-wire plugs, but keep in mind that your radio transmitter or transceiver, most of them are not actually powered directly from the AC line. They're powered instead by a power supply. How many wires does the power supply have going to the radio? It has two, not three, two. There's not usually a ground wire from the power supply to the radio. And that's a good thing to put in for that reason, because by various sneak paths and whatnot, and with coax cables connected here and there, you can end up with a potential difference between the transmitter chassis and ground, and you could have some voltage on the transmitter somehow that could be dangerous. So having a ground wire between each of your pieces of equipment, including the power supply and, oh, by the way, including the computer, which is usually tied to your equipment, will make things safer. They also will help with things like hum and noise that happens sometimes, particularly between sound cards and computers and radios, because oftentimes the power comes from different directions, and there can be potential differences between equipment. So that's electrical safety ground. That's sort of the most basic kind of ground. The next kind of ground we want to talk about is a RF ground. An RF ground is one that keeps radio frequency energy off of your cabinets. Now, you might think, well, I just went through this thing, and I have my electrical safety ground, all my equipment's hooked together, and it all goes back to the ground on the power system. Well, if it goes back there through the green wire in your household wiring, yes, eventually it gets there, but it could wander around through much of the house before it gets there. So it's not a low impedance. It's a good low impedance path for 60 cycle AC, 60 hertz AC, I guess we call it these days. But it's not a particularly low impedance path for RF. In fact, it may be quite a high impedance path. If you do get RF on your equipment, which often happens, pick up coupling directly from the antennas when you're radiating, it can get picked up on the wiring in your station. Sometimes if you don't have a properly terminated transmission line, you have common mode current coming down, you can have a lot of RF that comes down the shield of your transmission line, and you find your radio is hot, you lean towards your microphone and your whiskers curl a little bit if you have any.
You get a nip.
You can feel it on your... the hair is on the back of your hand if you run them near the equipment, usually.
Oh, yes.
And in extreme cases, you can have quite a number of problems. You can have RF that actually gets picked up on your microphone cord and causes feedback. So when you go to transmit, you hear a squeal instead of hearing your voice. Sometimes, in addition to that, even while on CW, you can push down the key and the radio transmits, and you lift up the key, and it doesn't stop transmitting because somehow the RF has gotten back in and has locked up the transmitter. And then you've got to turn off the transmitter and start working on this problem.
I've had that happen, Joel. You know I enjoy digital operating. But in some instances, you're right, where there has been RF, too much RF in the shack, it will lock up or has locked up my interface. I key the transmitter to start, say, a PSK31 transmission. And suddenly when I want to stop, boom. That's it. It just keeps right on going.
And your fingers can get really tired out if you just have to keep sending forever. You run out of things to say after a while. And the other guy's going to sleep anyway.
Well, Joel, let's take a quick break. We'll hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, and we want to talk more about RF grounding.
Yeah, we talked about the problems you get. We should probably talk about how you avoid them.
Yes.
So there are two aspects to this. One is to keep the RF out of the station. It's a good. That's not really RF grounding, but that's trying to solve this problem. So one way to do that is to have common mode chokes on your transmission lines, and that will help keep the RF from getting to your station. But there's always going to be some because the wiring in the station is near your antenna, even if it's 100 feet away, and you can pick up RF and have that cause problems. So the way you get rid of that is by grounding the equipment effectively for RF. Now that means you need a very low impedance ground wire that's much shorter than the wire that your safety ground uses. So what you want is typically you want to tie all of your equipment together, as you did for the RF, or for the safety ground. But in this case, you want to tie it together with lower impedance connections. Rather than relying on the plug in the wall, you want to have a short connection between each of the pieces of equipment, including your power supply and your computer, and one common ground point called a single point ground to which you take all of your grounds. This keeps ground current from running between equipment. So it goes from each piece of equipment to the ground, and then you want a short, heavy cable from that ground point, and each of the ground cables should be heavy also to reduce the impedance, to a good ground system, which means typically a little different from the ground system from the safety ground in that that could be, it needs to be a typically 1 or 2 8-foot ground rods buried in the earth, typically at least half the length apart from each other. And the AC currents can travel through all the earth, but RF current tends to stay near the surface, so more wires close to the surface are better than fewer wires pushed down into the earth for RF.
But what if you live on the fourth floor of a condominium and your station's up there? What do you do about that?
That is a common problem. The first thing you do is you bring all of your equipment together to that single point. And now what you can do is do the best job you can getting as direct a connection from that point to ground to through a ground cable that goes as directly as possible, if you can do it. Can't always put cables outside your condominium.
No.
Do what you can. And by having them all tied together, you minimize some of the coupling between things, and maybe then it's more important to worry about keeping the RF out than it is to worry about grounding it, because it's very hard to get a low impedance connection. But so what you do is try to build a little island of things that are all grounded together. Picture a shielded room all by itself. Instead of shielding, you just have everything tightly coupled together using ground wires, and that will help a lot.
What about a counterpoise? You've seen that, I'm sure, in some cases. For, again, I'm thinking of the second floor apartment type.
That's an interesting point. The a counterpoise is another thing you can do. This, what this does is it's sort of an artificial ground that takes advantage of the fact that we know that a quarter-wave antenna that is open at the far end has a low impedance at the near end. Now, instead of using this as a radiating device, we can use this as a way to act as a low impedance ground for a particular frequency by tying one end of that to the radio and having the other end go along the floor someplace where it's not going to touch anything else. And that will act as kind of a ground for RF at that one frequency.
At that one frequency. That's the trick.
But actually, a lot of times people find that for whatever reason, because of the way their antennas are oriented or whatever, that they will only have a problem on one or two frequencies. And if that's the case, this is a good solution, and it's pretty cheap. You just get a piece of wire and you run it out. And it you can do multiple frequencies by having multiple wires in different directions. Of course, you run out of rugs to put them under after a while. But so it's not necessarily a great solution for an 8-band station that has problems on all frequencies. But again, I start with common mode chokes to keep things out of your station. And if antennas come into an antenna tuner or antenna switching unit, have a good ground connection to your single point ground from that switch, which will help keep RF current from coming in on the outside of the shield even further into the station, but it won't stop it completely. And then, if you still have a problem, that counterpoise may be a way to go that'll help that.
Now, you're talking about ground functions. Another function that is extremely important, of course, is lightning protection.
Absolutely right. That is very important. And lightning is a tough duck to deal with. I mean, frankly, there are few things that can survive a direct lightning strike. Why is that? Well, lightning current typically has a peak current of about anywhere between 20,000 and 200,000 amperes. That's a lot of current. It rises in something like a millisecond, so it has a fair amount of high-frequency components to it, and that can melt almost anything. So people say lightning never strikes the same place twice, and that's almost true because in most cases the same place isn't there anymore. It's gone. That's not always true. But and some places get struck a lot by lightning. You look at
yes.
Empire State Building or some of these tall radio towers, they're constantly getting struck by lightning. And the key is to have a path for the lightning to get to ground without destroying something on the way. So if you have a heavy steel lattice tower that gets struck by lightning and most of the current goes down the tower itself into well-grounded tower legs, chances are it will not melt the tower. It may melt a wire if you force it on a wire, but it won't melt a tower typically, although sometimes that can happen. I mean, it can do dramatic things. If it hits a tree, it tends to go down the sap, and the sap gets so hot from the high current that it just explodes. It boils and explodes in the tree, and you have tree shattered tree all over the place. I've seen that happen more than once. And it'll find a way to ground eventually. There's no question about it. So the first thing is, whatever kind of ground situation or lightning situation you have, you want to get the lightning current to ground without going through the equipment or the house or any people or animals or whatever. Cows get killed around trees. Lightning hits a tree.
Oh, yeah. They go into the tree to get out of the rain.
And the current radiates out in all directions from the bottom of the tree, and the resistance of the ground results in a potential difference between two points. And if the cows happen to be standing along a radial line, they will end up with a voltage between their front legs and their back legs.
A big voltage.
A big voltage, and that'll take them down. And I thought about trying to patent this device, which would be a metal shoe that goes on all their feet and ties together to a single point in the middle of the cow, but that never went anywhere. And it was also a possibility for golfers, although the heat of that wire going through the midpoint of their legs would maybe be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So anyway, another one of my inventions that didn't go anywhere. But lightning will find a way to ground, and on the way, it will typically find multiple paths. And that's the point. People think about saying, well, I'll take this wire and the lightning will take this wire to ground. Well, no. The current will divide on any of the paths that it can find. And when you're dealing with, say, 200,000 amperes, it doesn't take a big percentage of the current to cause damage. So the trick is to peel off as much current as you can where it will do the least amount of damage, and then kind of have layers of protection as you go in. So if you have a tower-mounted antenna, your first point is to have each tower leg grounded multiple times on ground stakes that go out from each tower leg, perhaps 6 or 8 or 20 feet, and have a ground rod every 6 or 8 feet going out each leg, and that will take a big chunk of the current. The rest of it is still going to come down through the shields of the transmission lines and on your control cables towards the station. So you get to your station, and you have a antenna entrance panel, preferably at ground level, with very short leads to another ground system right there. By having another place at which the next layer of lightning current can get to ground, you remove the next fraction of it, and hopefully that will be most of it at that point. You have this panel that the shields are tied to, and another ground system at that point at your entrance panel. And at that point is a good place to put lightning arresters, because this is not exactly a grounding question, but it's more of a lightning protection question. We have this current going on the shield of the transmission line, which will have most of the current. Most of that will go to ground at that entrance panel. But what also happens is, even with good quality coax, coax is not perfectly shielded. So you get some amount, some fraction of the current on the shield ends up on the interconductor. And this is exacerbated, by the way, by having loose connectors, which are an entrance point for such signals. But even with good shield, you have a transfer impedance that takes a fraction of the current on the shield and puts it on the interconductor. So by having a lightning arrester at the entrance panel, you can cause that current to cause the lightning arrester to fire and take that current to ground along with the currents on the shield. So now you have a much smaller fraction of the current going towards the equipment and virtually none on the inside of the coax. But there will still be some. You can't have zero impedance, so you try to do the best you can in dividing off the currents. Now, I actually take a step. Not everybody thinks this is the way to do it, but I actually disconnect the coax on the inside of the panel if there's a lightning forecast or thunderstorm forecast, or if I'm going to be away for a weekend or something.
I do the same thing.
And I've made that easy to do in my case, because I have a bunch of antennas, and instead of having to unscrew all the connectors, I got a push-on adapters for the UHF connectors, and I just yank them off. And for my window line cables, I use double banana plugs, 3/4-inch spacing, which are almost perfect for window line, and I can just yank them off. So I can keep the lightning on the outside of the station. Now, some people think that's not a good idea, that you don't want it on the grounding scheme at all because it'll get somewhere. Some people recommend disconnecting it on the outside. There's nothing wrong with disconnecting it on the outside, except that if it's raining out and you're in your pajamas, you probably are not going to do it.
No, no.
Whereas with my arrangement, I just walk down, I give them a yank, and I'm done, and I don't have to scandalize my neighbors by running around in my pajamas and so forth. So that's helpful. And then, again, when you get to the equipment at the station, again, the shields should go to equipment, and all that equipment should be grounded to a single point, so there won't be any potential between the equipment. The other thing that's very important about your ground, particularly the one at the entrance panel, is that must be bonded to the electrical ground associated with your utility system. And that's actually a requirement of most building codes, any that are based on the National Electric Code. And the reason for that is very much like the cow thing. If the current is running through the ground and you don't have these grounds bonded together, you'll end up with a potential between them, and that'll result in currents running between the two grounds. And now you have currents, you're sort of forcing part of the current into your house and through your house, and it goes up all the green wires.
Lovely.
Yeah. So you want to have everything the same potential. Now, the optimum way to do that is actually to put a ring around your house of buried wire, number six or larger wire, and have a ground rod every so many feet, 10 or 20 feet, as you go around that. And every place that something comes into the house, be it a phone line or a cable TV system, the ground for that can tie to this same ground system. And that way you try to keep everything out of the house. And that can be quite effective. And that's sort of a commercial standard. The problem is many of these things are much easier to do before you build the house.
Yes.
Before you backfill the foundation.
Well, I was going to say, that sounds like a lot of work for the average ham to attempt.
Yeah, but if you're having your house built and the foundation is open, where they dug the hole for the foundation, it's a piece of cake to put in a ground ring around the house.
That's true.
Once you put in the shrubs and the driveways and the walks, it gets a little tougher. It still can be done. And you can come as close as you feel comfortable doing, you know, going. So maybe you can't get all the way around the house, but maybe you can get partway around the house. Or maybe everything is focused, all the entrances, and my house is at one end. So I actually have the wires at one end tied together in that way. And nothing else comes into the house as far as I can tell. So,
no, that's true. All right, Joel, Jim, KB5SYW is asking, when I tune my antenna with low power and read the standing wave ratio, then increase the power, the ratio increases. Why wouldn't it remain the same regardless of power?
Well, that's a good question, and it should. I mean, most antennas are, or certainly are intended to be linear, which means as you increase the power, all the ratios should stay the same. You should double the power, the reflected power should also double, and so forth, and the ratio should be constant. So if that isn't what you're seeing, I can think of three possible explanations. The first is that there actually may be something that's not linear. Nonlinearities are things like arc equipment that arcs over, connections are too close together and they arc, or something blows up because of power, too much power. This happens from time to time. But typically, you wouldn't be more aware of that happening, and usually they don't continue to happen. Once they blow up from then on,
that's it.
But things can change just because of heating. For example, ferrites. There are ferrites in the system. They're notorious for that because while they work very well at being a core material for transformers and chokes, if they do absorb power, they're very poor at radiating power. So the heat tends to build up in them. As you increase the power of your transmitter, they will get hotter, and that will tend to change their characteristics, and that can make a difference in standing wave ratio depending on what they're doing in the system. Usually, eventually, they'll break. They'll actually fracture. But you could be at the point below that, and it could just change things. So that's something to be aware of. Other things can heat up, too. A coax cable that's mismatched particularly can get quite hot. I've burned myself on coax. It indicates a high SWR, usually. But I haven't seen that cause a change in the characteristics until it gets particularly until it starts to melt, which doesn't usually happen. So that's one kind of a thing, is something that gets nonlinear because of the power level. I think that's fairly unlikely. A more likely cause is that the standing wave ratio measuring equipment is not quite linear. Now, this could be because different power ratios that are measured just because of the metering circuitry that responds differently at different power levels. I mean, that can happen. So that could be what's happening.
Like the diodes are not linear.
Diodes in general are not linear, but normally they're operated in a range in which they will act like they're linear. And the easy way to check this is to put another known good standing wave ratio or power meter in the system right at the antenna and watch what happens to that and check the two against each other. If they both change standing wave ratio as the power increases, then it's probably something in the antenna system. But if one of them, particularly if it's known to be a good one, indicates a constant standing wave ratio or a constant ratio of reflected power, which is equivalent, then it's probably the first meter that's not reading linearly. The third possibility is that you may not be measuring what you think you're measuring. You say you notice this when you increase power. Well, if you increase power by turning on your linear amplifier, what you've done is you've actually, if you're measuring the standing wave ratio by looking at the SWR meter in your transceiver, which measures what it sees, and you had your linear amplifier turned off, that's in bypass mode, and you're actually measuring the antenna system as you do that. If you increase your power by turning your linear amplifier on, now you're no longer measuring the standing wave ratio of your antenna system, you're measuring the standing wave ratio of the input circuit of your linear amplifier, which has very little to do with the antenna in most cases. So the answer to that is to put the power meter that can handle the full transmit power on the output of the linear amplifier. And if all is working properly, when the linear amplifier is turned off, you should read the same standing wave ratio on the transceiver as you read on the standing wave ratio meter at the output of the amplifier, because the amplifier is in bypass mode. When you turn the linear amplifier on, the standing wave ratio at the output should not change because the antenna system is still the same.
That's right.
But the transceiver will see a different standing wave ratio because it's now measuring the input impedance of the linear amplifier. Now, another thing I should mention is that some standing wave ratio meters require an adjustment to calibrate them at each power level. So that's another thing that can change. Mm-hmm. When you have whatever power level you're measuring, you should put the key down for a moment and if it's the kind of standing wave ratio meter that has a calibrate position, you put the transmitter on and you adjust the calibration for a particular full scale reading in the calibrate position, and then when you take it off calibration, you should get the actual standing wave ratio. And you have to change that adjustment at every power level. So that's another thing that could be happening. So those are the reasons I can think of. There may be others that somebody can come up with. I'm guessing you'll find that the answer is in one of those areas.
I would suspect so. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.